Chairman Fred has provided us with our speaker tonight, and his local boy makes good, David. Thank you. I did that right, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yes.
All right.
Hi, everybody. My name is David. And does that sound pretty good? Can you hear me in the back? Okay. Check one. Just wave if I'm not loud enough. I want to say, firstly, I'm a very grateful member of the Al-Anon program. Fred, thank you for inviting me, and it's really nice to be here with you folks tonight and see some old friends and some newer friends and meet some new people. So I'm glad to be here with you and share with you our program together. I would like to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And I'll tell you a little bit about my family, and maybe I'll start off with this term qualifier gets used in Al-Anon, and it's often meant to refers to the alcoholic in our lives, the person who the person sort of who got us in here because their drinking was troubling us or bothered us. And in that sense, my both parents were alcoholics. My mother, my father, my brother would later become an addict. And so those are qualifiers, but I want to be quick to say right at the onset here that by the time I came into the Al-Anon program, it was very clear to me that I qualified myself for the program. And I'll explain sort of what I mean by that. But it was very, very clear to me I wasn't coming in the doors because another person, because I was annoyed or upset with or driven crazy by another person's drinking. I had a breakdown without a lot of, without really any outward chaos going on in my life, without any outward dramatic event. So more on that in a minute. A little bit about my family. I'd like to tell you about my parents first. My father was born in Stuttgart, Germany. He was born in 1939, and so his formative years were in Germany in the post-World War II years. And he was exposed to our Armed Forces radio network, GIs over there, what they listened to, and he fell in love with American country music. And he had a dream. His dream was to come to Nashville, Tennessee, and get in that field, and which he did probably in around 1960 or so. And my father, as I said, was an alcoholic, and I can't give you a firsthand account of his drinking because he did get sober in the AA program when I was about 1 year old. So I didn't know him as a drinker. I only knew him as a sober member of AA, and as a very active member in our fellowship too, in the Al-Anon fellowship. And so, so I can tell you a little bit, secondhand, that he was, a life of the party type drunk. He was well loved. People who remember him, it's usually fond memories. But of course, alcoholism, as we all know, gets often or always gets worse and has a, certainly an ugly side. And, it was, I'm sure, took its toll on the marriage and took further and further tolls. And eventually my parents would divorce. They had a child, my older brother, and my dad was still drinking. He returned to Germany. He had another relationship and had another child. And then my parents got back together again and had me. So I always like to mention that my brother and I have the same parents, but we are from two different marriages. And so that second marriage also took place. The second marriage took place still. My dad was still drinking, but he would sober up very, very soon after that. Like I say, I was about a year old. And as he told it, it was a very dramatic experience for him when he found his program, his AA program. And he would never drink again. And I only knew my dad sober and active. When I think back, he's deceased. And he was a real role model for me. And I grew up coming quite a number of times to his meetings, his AA meetings. Here, this is now here in Los Angeles. My mom was a Southerner, by the way, and they did live in the South for a long time. But my dad, to kind of start a new life, I'm sure he'd burned a lot of bridges, in his field and so forth, came and started over in Los Angeles. So I was born in the South, but really raised here, just down the hill in the Silver Lake area of Los Angeles. And this growing up, my growing up years, I had a lot of program influence. Some very fond memories come to mind. My dad taking me to his Saturday night young people's AA meeting, Plymouth Wilshire. Which is actually, it's kind of funny to think, he was young enough to be going to a young person's meeting. And I would like to express to you what I felt in those meetings. I loved his friends. The speakers, of course, up here at the podium told exciting stories. His friends were welcoming to me. They were warm. That camaraderie in the room, I could feel it. And I got to drink coffee, and I was just a kid. And I remember thinking, feeling that I had a dilemma, and that dilemma was, I would like to be part of this someday, this fellowship, this group, but I sure don't want to have to travel the roads that these people have, meaning the recovered alcoholics, to have your life go to hell, and to go through all the things that I heard from the podium, And so, little did I know that there would be a program for me, the Al-Anon program, but I would find out about that later. And my growing up years, I have these memories of AA. My dad would have me go to Alateen once in a while. It didn't take with me. Went a few times. I certainly later in life went to, when I say later in life, I mean now I'm 16 or 17, 18 years old, later in my youth, my growing up youth. I would go to Al-Anon meetings and with him, and but I would say that my attitude at the time went something like this. I get the disease concept. I've heard it throughout my life, that it's a disease. We didn't cause it. We can't cure it. We can't control it. I accepted that. That made sense to me. And so my thinking at that time was, why would I need to be active in a program? I get it. I'm not trying to get my mom to stop drinking. I'll segue to her in a minute. I get it. So that was my attitude at that time. So my dad recovered in 1967. My mom's drinking kicked in just a few years after that. So she became really, and she was the active alcoholic in my household that I knew and grew up with. And so I'll describe a little bit about what that was like in the family. So my mom, I would describe her as a periodic. And she was sober for fairly lengthy periods of time. It feels like it probably was 6 months. It's difficult to that. That's my memory, so I'll go with that. And then we'd lose her for about one week, is how I remember it. We'd lose her to, how I put it, the bottle, to cigarettes, and to the telephone. And so these three things went together for her. And what I mean by that is, the household would be a well-run household. She was a traditional mom, wasn't in the working world. And, running a good house and so forth, kids getting, kids off to school. And And then the drinking would start, and she would retreat to her bedroom. And, you know, the household would, there would be a black cloud over the household. And I say the telephone because that was just, that was what my mom did when she, and not, you know, I guess I should explain that a little bit more. I mean, just on the phone forever, you know. I remember tension in the household over phone bills, you know, and I feel like they might, you know, we're obviously going back, you know, 40 years, you know, maybe $700 or $900 was like, a phone bill for them, you know. So this was a lot of time kind of just calling people all around the country, relatives, and in this state she would get into. And then, like I said, the smoking. And that all went together. And then my mom would come back to sobriety to get her, pull things together. And then we'd have another 6 months. So this is the cycle that went on. And the family went into a different mode when she was drinking. You know, my father and my older brother would take over the chores, and we'd go out to dinner and so forth. And this would happen. And so that's kind of the picture I can give you. And this went on, I think, for several years. And if I'd be at school, you know, at 3 o'clock, you know, if I knew everything, if my mom wasn't there waiting for me, you know, it told me the whole story. You know, the drinking had started. My dad would eventually get me, and, you know, and he would just say, you know, your mother's drinking, you know, and I'd say, you know, gotcha. So this was our household, and, you know, this is that second marriage. So this went on for several years. And finally, my parents would divorce for a second time, and for good. But by this time, my father had gotten into Al-Anon, like I mentioned, and had, you know, listening to his story, had learned a lot about himself and his role, as we do when we get into Al-Anon. And probably when I was about 15 or 16, they divorced. And those next couple of years were, I'll tell you the good and the bad. You know, the good would be that I was living with my mom. And, you know, when you're living with, an alcoholic, you know, you're relatively unsupervised. And so I really kind of ran wild in the city here. And that was good at the time. You know, just a little supervision, did a lot of what I wanted. The bad, of course, is obvious, that it was, I wouldn't have been able to express it to you at the time. But, you know, that you feel that here, you know. Later, that would be directed upon towards me and my family. And so this went on for a couple of years. And probably when I was about 17, my mother, I'm thinking it was 16, 17, 18, she threw me out in a drunken rage. And I moved in with my father and had a couple of years of a very sane and loving family life, very stable. He had remarried, and my stepmom was a really neat woman, and my mother's drinking continued to get worse. And so thank goodness for that. You know, as I look back, you know, I mean, we all know the stories, but, you know, my mother, there was plenty of drama in our lives. I can remember my mom, you know, kind of chasing us in the car, you know, on my way to school, and you know, all this anger directed at my dad. And, you know, this was just, you know, just went on for quite some time. And so I had these couple of years with my dad and my stepmother. And it was about that time that I started to develop a number of problems, and I'll tell you about those in some detail. But I think I'll take a moment and say that a part of the Al-Anon story, my Al-Anon story that I want to share with you tonight, kind of I think of it as having two main roads or two main areas. One would be the way what Al-Anon has given to me in terms of tools to deal with the alcoholics in my life. And with others, and that would include my brother. And I'll tell you a few things that have happened over the years, and how Al-Anon has been so instrumental to me and so helpful to me. But really, the main part of that, my Al-Anon story, that's closer to my heart, is how Al-Anon has helped me live more comfortably with myself, someone who was having a birthday, you know, talk about being more comfortable in your own skin. And so that's, I'll probably focus a little bit more on that tonight, because that's the more important part to me of my story. But when I was about 17 or 18, I started to develop all sorts of obsessions and compulsions, obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. And, you know, I wouldn't have known what to call it. All I knew is I was washing my hands to a degree like you can hardly imagine. I played a musical instrument, and my fear, my phobia wasn't really germ focused. It was more fastidiousness, and before I touched my instrument, sneaking off to the bathroom, you know, and washing, to the point that over, you know, a period of time, you know, my hands were raw and, you know, just a mess. And of course I was hiding this, and I had a great shame over it. Wasn't masculine. It was, you know, I was an outgoing person, but these were behaviors that began to blossom that I was wanting to hide because I had shame over them. And of course they were out of control and not good for me at all. And that's probably one of the earliest things that I can remember was this hand washing. Now, again, I hadn't found Al-Anon yet for real, only had flirted with the program, you know, and come to a meeting here or there. And, but it got worse and worse. And I started to have other irrational phobias and fears just pop into my head, and they would grip me. I would become fearful there's not enough air in the room and start analyzing that, or that I needed to think about how deeply I was breathing, or maybe I wasn't getting enough air and I would get brain damage, and on and on and on, just very, very basic things that, you know, one doesn't need to think about. And when you do, well, in my case at least, it led to panic attacks. And I began having panic attacks. And so my outward life, you know, I had a career going. I had met a woman, a non-drinker. We were, you know, developing a life together. But this prison of my mind was getting worse and worse and worse. And so it did. And finally, one week, I was 21. I was doing some home repair work. I was putting in a sprinkler system and working with solvents and so forth, pipes and solvents and so forth. And I just started imagining, okay, I must have solvent on my hand, and I just wiped my nose. It's in my nose. Every breath now, I'm getting fumes. I'm getting brain damage. And I went into an all-out panic attack that night. And we'd be getting married later, but my girlfriend took me to the hospital, took me to an emergency room. And the doctor prescribed me, you know, I explained what was going on, but I was just a mess. And they prescribed some Xanax, and you know, I took some there at the hospital, North Hollywood Medical Center, and went home. And the next day, well, those next 4 days were the blackest of my life. I saw no possible way that I could feel calm or serene or happy, certainly happy. That just seemed impossible to me. And again, I want to stress this, what I just told you. There's no crazy, I was, you know, not married to an alcoholic who's out of control. My mom's not out of, you know, this is just life on the outside looks fine, and I am coming up, I've come apart at the seams inside. And so on that next day, I was moved for some reason. I decided not to continue with the pills I had been given. And on the fourth day, I called my dad and I asked him if he'd take me to an Al-Anon meeting. And so I was 21, and my dad came. I managed to go to work that day, and my dad came to my office. It was really very touching. I mean, he was right there for me. And after work, probably 6 o'clock, he walked me across the street to a meeting in Cedars-Sinai Hospital. It's still there. It's Thursday 7:30 meeting. And I mark that as my true beginning in the Al-Anon program. That was my first meeting, as far as I'm concerned, because that night in that meeting was the first time in my life that I raised my hand and I shared. I'd never shared in the meeting before. I wouldn't have known what to share. I was too self-conscious, didn't relate to the steps. I respected the steps, but I didn't relate to them in any way on a level here. And so I raised my hand in that meeting and I shared exactly what was going on, and that was a real first for me, because I was hiding all of this stuff from you, from everyone. And people came up to me after that meeting and hugged me, as hopefully everyone in the room I know has experienced, whether you're new or just came in or an old timer, and started sharing their stories with me. So people really couldn't reach out in a significant way until I was willing to be vulnerable and tell you at least a little bit about what it was like to be me and the pain that I was going through. And so I marked that as my beginning in the program. Just an aside, I mentioned, I didn't continue with the what I'd been prescribed. Just want to be very clear, that's not any statement, anti-medication where that's appropriate and prescribed. And obviously, when that is appropriate, that certainly gives people a lot of help who need that. But in my case, I just mentioned that because that's the way it unfolded for me. And so that was the beginning. That was the first night. And I went to a meeting a day for, probably 90 days, what you all recommend. And that meeting a day, that hour and a half, was the only, moment in the day where I felt any hope that I could make it, there was a shot for me. So I think I want to take a few minutes here. I'd like to talk about, I'd like to hit all the steps, but I'll certainly want to start with the first few and what they meant to me at that time and what they mean to me now. But I mentioned I respected the steps, but did not relate to them. So let me tell you a little bit more about what began to unfold for me. So the first step, powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Heard that, like I say, my whole life, bought it 100%. I get it. It was when I started to hear people in meetings say powerless over people, places, and things. But it was the first person I heard say powerless over our own first impulse, crazy thoughts and emotions, which spoke right to me, because I knew that my head was filled with first impulse, crazy thoughts, like the fears I told you, and I was trying to stop having those things happen. And, I got this gentle message from the program, hey, we don't need to worry about that. It's that second impulse in what we do after that. That's something that we have can exercise some control over and take some action. And so, that was a golden key that was handed to me by you. And so what that meant on a more practical level was I could begin doing things that would put me, sometimes immediately, into a better place. Going to meetings, of course, was the most basic one that was being done by the people, you guys who were already in here, sharing at meetings, taking a commitment, reading about the steps, attempting to work the steps in my life, but many other tools. And you all shared so many things that were helpful. Get your hands busy with something that needs to be done, the next chore that needs to be done, the next indicated action. I'm always reminded, I think of it as something Chuck C said in the AA program, but you can't think yourself into right
acting, that you can act yourself into right thinking. And this kind of idea, people said it in different ways, made so much sense to me. So I began to notch down in my worry about what went on in my head, knowing that I could do sane actions that were recommended to me by others, and begin to feel better. And so one of the most important, I would say, spiritual experiences that I can articulate to you is the feeling that I think it's always happened every meeting I've gone to, and it's such a wonderful thing. And it's the sense that you may have a list, I may have a list of 8 or 10 or 20 or 4 unresolved problems or even obsessions. And then all of a sudden finding yourself in the meeting feeling whole, good, and serene, or relatively serene, maybe even a little bit happy, and nothing has changed about those problems or obsessions. They haven't been directly worked on at all. And before the meeting, I was having a little chat with a couple of members, and the gentleman expressed something really, really similar to that. And so Al-Anon started lifting my wings, meaning you all did, my higher power, the group spirit, the spirit of the program, and put me in touch with something that was very different than I need to work on my problems directly. I need to solve these particular problems. And of course, if there's obsession, you know, maybe some of you or all of you can relate, working harder on obsession, of course, you know, makes it worse. And you know, that's not a, you know, we have a slogan, think, and of course the think slogan is really helpful for a lot of things, but it's the opposite is also useful for me, you know, which is to get into action, get into a conversation with another person, and get out of here, you know, and be lifted in that way by the program. The second step, you know, I didn't come into this program with an issue with God, any, you know, problematic issues, but I didn't have any sense of a working faith with a higher power. And boy, did that change in Al-Anon. You know, you just heard how people, they just said, trust in your higher power. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Trust in your higher power. And I did. You know, maybe I don't have to be self-reliant in this way, or I really realized that I couldn't be, it didn't work. And that I could trust that a higher power would restore me to sanity in that way I was describing and in other ways. And so that was my first experience with trusting in a higher power, trusting in God, you know, that I use both terms. The third step, you know, we're entirely ready to have, turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him, was taking those suggestions from others. Again, at the most basic level, come to meetings. You know, I always like to say this, especially when he's here. I know Willie's in the room somewhere. So this is a good little story, a little more personal because it's one of our members here. But it was in that first year or two, I was at a big meeting in North Hollywood. It was such a big meeting. They had a four-person on the coffee commitment. You know, it was election time. And so, you know, I wasn't going to, you know, volunteer. And Willie was sitting next to me, and he did this. And just sort of, do you even remember that?
Yeah.
He does. Because I tell it every time he's in the audience. I tell it when he's not in the audience, too. And, you know, thank you, Willie. I'll always thank you for that. I got on that committee of four, and you know, I was part of that meeting. I played a real part getting there early, which reminds me, Gene Kay has a saying, if you're not at a meeting 30 minutes early, you're late. I don't achieve that high standard, but I do try to get to meetings early. But that this got me to the meeting way early. And I was part of, and I'm not making light when I say that I really had the experience of a coffee commitment, seeing how a coffee commitment could solve very complicated problems. Like, that was just what I found. I unwound, these knots just unwound. And like I said, I had this experience that I know, you know, everyone in the room has had, or I hope has had, of being lifted and not working directly on the problem. Speaking of problems, I'm watching the time. I want to pack a lot of it in, and when I say pack it in, so much has been helpful to me in Al-Anon. So I want to just zing a bunch of things out there that have been helpful to me. One thing, jumping to current, for me to be willing to question anything that I think is the key to making me happy that's outside of myself. And, you know, whatever that is, you know, I'll be serene when I get this project done. I'll be serene when I get through this talk tonight, you know, which, you know, I always get nervous before I'm speaking. Tonight's no exception. I'll be happy when this business deal happens. You know, I can definitely say to you with a straight face, intellectually, I know none of that has the key to have any impact on my happiness whatsoever. That doesn't mean I get caught up in those types of things, and of course I do. More would be like, let me just, you know, I just can't wait till I get through something, you know, then I can relax, you know. And it's really not true. And so that's been a very helpful thing for me, and it's a program thing, is anything outside of myself that I think is a key, you know, to happiness, just, it's a good idea for me to question that. So my fourth and fifth steps, you know, were really, really great experiences. I've done that three times in the program, but, you know, the first time I was, you know, I was in my early 20s. I'm 52 now. And so I called my dad up and I said, do you have somebody to recommend that I read my inventory to? I love my dad and I trusted him. And he says, you know, yes, I really respect this man, so-and-so. And I called that man up and I made an appointment and I had done my fourth step. And just a bit on my fourth step, what I did was very helpful for me. I just tried to write everything about myself that I wouldn't want you to know. I mean, that's really what I tried to do. So, you know, all my insecurities, where I felt inferior to people, where I felt superior to people, my sexual history, sexual desires, all the vandalism I'd done as a kid, ugly things. You know, again, this inventory is being done, so it's looking back, you know, on teenage years. Where I'd let people down, where I was just a jerk, you know, and so on and so forth, you know, and I read this inventory to him. And, you know, so that was my guidepost, is to not be a filter or to be a censor myself, to, you know, just put it on paper. And that was a very good idea for me, because I knew I was afraid for the world to know, or for, I'm sorry, for anyone in the world to know about me deep down, who I really was. You know, and I read that to him, and I read that fifth step, and I think he said, you know, that was nice, or that was good, you know, and he had a few comments, and that was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Switching, because I don't want to miss out on telling you a few things about the alcoholics in my life. My mother's drinking got worse, and her anger was focused very much on my father, and it went on that way for many years. I'm happy to say she eventually recovered. And my father, I was 24. We were hiking together, and my father died of a heart attack, and on our trail hike, and you know, I just couldn't couldn't believe that he had, you know, that I'd lost him. I know there's people out there, you know, who lost a parent early, and you know, of course that changed my life. And I would take over his business. I took a couple weeks to decide that. Never forget his memorial program, people. You know, how lovely was that AA and Al-Anon gathered together. What support we got as a family. And my mother, though, her anger turned on me and my family. That's what happened in the next phase. So as far as my Al-Anon experience, where it's helped with alcoholics and continues to, I'm giving you a few older stories. You know, I had to do things like, eventually I had to block my mom from being able to even call my household, because, you know, it was so disturbing late at night or whatever. You know, that was just what I did for probably a year or two. And that, because that anger was at me and my wife, And I did, you know, I wanted to protect my family, and I did, you know. And that phase would eventually pass. You know, there were lots of suicide attempts with my mother. That actually goes back a little further than I'm at now in my story. But, you know, calling 911 and these things that we do with suicide attempts and so forth. And but my mom's drinking continued to get worse. My brother became an addict and an alcoholic. You know, and Al-Anon, you know, gives us all, certainly gave me choices on how to handle things, you know. And I can remember one in particular, very, very ill-conceived rescue attempt by my grandparents and my mother to rescue my brother who lived in Connecticut. You know, it was just a fiasco. And I did not take part in it at all. And it turned out horribly. They basically, I think, were kind of virtually trying to kidnap him to, you know, to save him with good intentions. But it was a, you know, not a professional intervention or anything well planned. And, you know, Al-Anon helped me say no to that. It's helped me say no to my brother, you know, wanting to borrow my car, knowing that that's dangerous for the public. It's dangerous for my financial life. It's dangerous for him personally. You know, these things don't really go over well with people. You know, but we learn that we can do these things. You know, giving my brother money. My brother's had big jobs, a big career. Now he's in very, very bad shape. You know, I think mostly from addiction problems and also some health problems. And fortunately, he lives in a foreign country where they have a good social, he gets taken care of, and I'm so grateful for that. But, you know, my brother has done a lot of asking for money over the years, you know. And, you know, I've sometimes given my brother money. And you know what? A number of times I've turned him down, you know. And Al-Anon gives me that that choice to, you know, to have those boundaries. And make a decision that's right for me. I had a I want to spend a minute on blind spots. You know, I've had a number of over the years. I can tell you about blind spots where things were going on for years, and I wasn't making any recovery or anything. So I'll tell you about those. I would tell you about my current blind spots, but I'm blind to them. So if someone invites me in 5 years or 10 years, I might have a. You know, I had a recovered alcoholic business partner. Much success with him. He was a charismatic person, and helped me in my life. Helped the business. But our relationship started to turn very, very bad in the last, you know, several years of our relationship. And I was ashamed, not ashamed to tell you now, but I was ashamed then. I became afraid of him. He was so powerful to me, personality-wise. I mean, he was a powerful personality. That's objectively true. But I was afraid of this person, and I began to shrink in that relationship. And ironically, I was the main owner, and so I had the power in that sense of the business. But I shrank and I was scared, and this went on for years, and I didn't say a word in Al-Anon because I was kind of embarrassed by the kind of things he did, you know, he did to me, you know, verbally, and the kind of abuse and things like that. But I did snap. It took several years. And, you know, and it's the things we talk about in this program. I just had a realization and I wrote out like 8 behaviors that he did. I had no need to bore you with the details, but they, you know, just inappropriate in the workplace and not sexual harassment, just, you know, verbally, just way over the top with people. And I said, these are no longer going to happen in my firm. This is the end. Oh, that was... did not go over well. I mean, he said one or two things, you know, you don't own me, and then he hung up the phone. But you know what? It only took 1 week, maybe two, before I had complete clarity on that relationship after setting those boundaries. And my clarity in that case was that we were going to be, I wanted a divorce, a business divorce. And that's what I did, and it took probably 6 months. That was probably my biggest blind spot that I can tell you about in Al-Anon. And that's 15 years ago, you know, so I didn't think I'd make it without him. You know, I was scared to death. And, but you know, it's funny, I'd already made the decision, so support afterwards was just a nice thing. It wasn't key, but when people started to come up afterwards and tell me their perspective and on what I had done, it was like, wow, you know, I mean, it was helpful, but I had made the decision and that was over. And so that was a big part of my Al-Anon life. My sponsor talks about how the program is a living program, and I love how he says this, but it's along these lines. Al-Anon comes alive for me with my participation in the program. It comes alive, you know, he would say, we can't just like, you know, take a book and like go off on our own and possess the knowledge of the program. That it comes alive in the meetings and with people and conversations and so forth. And I've, of course, have found that so true. It's my participation is the key to everything. And so I'm thrilled to be participating in Al-Anon all these years and now. A little bit of a current recovery in these last few minutes. So a few hallmarks for me in Al-Anon. I find that I need to take what feel like risks in my life, every day of my life, in order to be okay and grow. And I want to give you an example. Remember I told you that I had a hand washing obsession when I was 18. Well, the hand washing obsession, I did sort of 80% stop that. And we talk in this program about contrary action, so this kind of ties together. And for those of you who maybe can't relate to the specific example, that would only be a few people, but it symbolically works on for me on a lot of different levels. But that didn't go away all the way for me. And only relatively recently did I decide to face that. And I was still very fastidious, had lots of rules. I need to wash my hands after I pump gas or before I play my instruments or, you know, this or that. So, you know, it wasn't in the bathroom for 20 minutes, but it was a ritual, you know. Once I became willing to face this, somebody gave me some very, very good advice. And they said, you know, if you want to recover from this, it's not about just stopping washing your hands. You need to actually intentionally contaminate your hands and then not wash them and then do that repeatedly. And but if you want to know about contrary action working, and if you've got a ritual, I don't care what it is, here's what they told me to do. Wipe a car tire black and go play all your favorite precious instruments. And I did that. And I wiped a tire this morning, by the way. And I don't need to do that every day. That's just in my repertoire of keeping me sane in that department of my life. And so, that's very specific, but that works, that kind of thinking, contrary action, works for me, that I have to swing my pendulum back in the opposite direction and always be, regularly, not always, do things out of my comfort zone or else my world gets smaller and smaller. And the kind of obsessions and phobias I have, by the way, which just to say briefly, for whatever reason, mine were mostly body focused, so hand washing. I had a fear, a terrible obsession about my eyesight getting worse, becoming more nearsighted, and doing eye exercises and, you know, different glasses and so forth, that it was really paralyzing. That was one. I had a fear of anxiety that, oh my God, if I get into this much anxiety like I do, I'm going to lose my hair like prematurely, like it's being lost right now while I'm in the anxiety, so I need to stop being anxious immediately. And so, you know, that makes you more anxious, by the way. And that leads me to another very, very important idea that Al-Anon talks about, which is, for me, it's a very, very bad idea to avoid things that shouldn't be avoided. Confrontations that need to take place. Facing things that need to be faced, phone calls that need to be made, the hard work that needs to be done. If I avoid it, I'm increasing my burden. And so for me, that means a lot of little things, you know. A lot of things, and some of them are seemingly very, very small, but they all add up. And the most important thing is, I know what my stuff is, and so it, you know, it may seem small to you all, but if it's my stuff, it's probably difficult, you know, just like our own stuff is difficult. And so, you know, so when I'm throughout my day, you know, it might be, like I say, the difficult phone call, the telling somebody that I'm angry with them and why, in a, you know, in a mature way, or that they hurt my feelings, or it might be, you know, wearing an article of clothing that's like outside of my seven comfortable shirts, you know. I actually, on that note, when I got this shirt out, this has a spot right here, by the way. And I literally made a decision to wear this shirt with a spot because it's a good exercise of, you know, having an imperfection like that I could potentially obsess on instead of sharing, you know, and thinking about what I'm saying with you. So, you know, again, like a little thing, but that can be very, very meaningful to me. And of course, there's the bigger things, you know, boundary setting with people. And so that clock's good, 25 after, right? So taking care of myself, that's all I'm going to get in tonight. Very important. Al-Anon talks about it all the time, you know, whether it be the most basic things of coming to meetings and continuing to participate, you know, to eating well and exercising, you know, in my case, I give myself quite a lot of time away from phones and from email. A lot of times I don't carry a phone, you know, and things of this have been helpful to me, solitude and nature, as well as being with people. It's that back and forth mix. So leisure time and time for relaxation, not always having to be productive. There's just a zillion things that could be said and are said in our meetings about taking care of oneself. So I'll sum up by saying I love Al-Anon, and it, to me, nothing could be more worth doing for its own sake. It is not a means to an end for me. It's just part of my life and worth doing. So, I mean, I intend to keep coming. That's my intention, my feeling for the rest of my life. And as my sponsor says, with that kind of a mindset, there's no such thing as a bad meeting. There's no such thing as looking for a good meeting. Just every meeting is just a time to participate and meet someone or talk with someone you already know and let that spirit of the program come alive and do its mysterious work. So thanks for having me, everybody.